This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Yeah, Frank here, he's got his own billiard room.
Yes, it's what do you call it, Kramer?
The billiard room.
No.
The name.
The billiard. Not billiard. What? Not the billiards. It was... Come on, Rudy. What? Come on. We call it the place to
be. The place to be. Yes, it's the place to be.
Then I shall be there.
This is the place to be here tonight.
Time to play the game.
Party people in the place to be. Uh-huh. It's about that time.
Place to Be Nation, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
I think they might hear shock wall.
Actually, it's being John Akiyama is a better version of it.
What do you think, Woodley? You can finally tell Grant Owens you found new music.
I'll tell you what, I am impressive. Mm-hmm.
Channel Lawson Bram? Let's get him a rinky dinky dink.
Yeah.
Hey, Nate, man, this is pretty much a highlight of my life right now. I had no idea you were going to be here. I wanted to drive that freaking whole train of my whole youth. You're the man.
And I thought he meant Nate Milton, the godfather from Kings of Sport. Do you really think that's the godfather?
Yeah, I did.
All you have to do is break out that fuck money.
I ate the pop. Up your mouth, you scraggly Canadian.
That's a bit much. You, who murdered the dog with the sword, and I'm being a little too much.
Yeah, I like Big Dick myself. I'm just curious. 5 years! 5 years! We've been doing podcasts. And we have this. This is trash.
To do worse than Josh Richard.
Nation, welcome back to the great episode of the one and only Place to Be podcast. I am your host, Adjuster Zero, coming to you live here on this Monday evening. And of course, alongside me, as always, is my PIC, Scott Criscola. Scott, how are you?
Good evening, JR. Good evening, Place to Be Nation. Welcome to episode 440 of the Gold Standard, the mothership. And you, JR, probably quite relaxed on this Monday evening, considering what you had on Saturday morning / afternoon. You had your own little Royal Rumble of birthday minions throughout your house on Saturday.
The whole weekend was really a busy one. We had my son's second birthday party. It was like 50-something people in the house, so that was nonstop.
48 of them under the age of three. It seemed like it anyway.
Before that, of course, your Providence College Friar, Scott, defeated St. John's to hopefully clinch a NCAA tournament bid. We'll see how that plays out, but it looks like they're in good shape. So that started the day off well. Yeah, then we had the party. And then, Sunday, of course, I had a crew here as well to watch Fastlane, which ended up being a bit of a turd of a pay-per-view. But we had a lot of wings and a lot of laughs, so it was still a good time.
Yep. No, it was kind of quiet this weekend. Festive day on Saturday. The doctor's, Dr. G's daughter, won the her team won the 8th grade varsity girls championship in their league. They
Coach
won the finals.
Armento leading them to the title.
Tex winner there. Yeah. He's there to keep score. What the hell was his name in Bad News Bears? The one that kept scoring and would just lean into the pitch.
I thought it was like Ogilvy.
Ogilvy, yeah, that's he's their Ogilvy. That's what he
I thought
is.
It was like Dangerous Minds, you know, him leading the troops and breaking them out of the inner city and bringing them to the championship.
Oh, yeah, because he's intimidating in the ghetto. And then yesterday, just relax, nothing crazy. And then the doctor and Johnny Reckless came over last night. We watched Fastlane ourselves again. Had some pizza, had a good time, exchanged some DVDs, and watched a big giant turd as well. So the same turd you did, so... but tonight, JR, we're not watching. Well, actually, we might be watching a turd tonight as well, depending on your point of view. But not a busy weekend as we head into March. Of course, it is WrestleMania season, and a little tipping our hat a little bit to when we talk about the website later. Another great installment today, JR, of our WrestleMania Listomania.
Yes,
they've been fantastic so far. The first 6 days.
We're up to seven that are out. We started last Tuesday, I believe. So.
Yeah. Oh, so you started February 20. Okay. So yeah, and today was best
arenas.
Oh, the arenas in general. That's right.
Yep.
best arenas. And, of course, the Madison Square Garden was number one. But these top 10s have been fantastic. So if you haven't checked them out, kind of tipping ahead. We'll mention more of it later in the show. But head to placebnation.com because we worked pretty hard. And tabulating our top, you know, formulating the lists, all the great people that chipped in. And then you and Chadley and what is it, Deloitte and Touche or Ernst & Young or whoever does the Oscars or whatever, putting together the tabulating the votes.
Yeah, not fun. That was a lot of math, especially, too, because everyone wasn't, like, uniform in how they wrote the number of the show or the name. You know, like, it would be, like, Shawn Michaels versus Undertaker would be one entry, and then it would be, like, Shawn Michaels' retirement, you know, would be the next one, you know, like, in the same category. So, you know, it was, like, it was a lot of you know, it wasn't just an easy way to look and tally. So it was a lot of back and forth. And then you get people who missed entries or put double and you're going to run them.
It was a lot.
It was a lot of work. But it was a rewarding work because I think they look really nice and I think they've been pretty popular. And they're going to run every day until the day before WrestleMania, April 1st. So there's 33 of these things to represent, of course, 33 years of WrestleMania.
Big-timed. And on my way. I can't believe that only was like number, what, 5? I was hoping it'd be higher. That's okay.
You should have put a number 1. We'll give those extra votes.
I forgot what I had number 1. Oh, I had, well, I mean, the 6, 7, and 8, you know, the original theme. It's hard not to vote that one. But
well, I think My Way finished first, and then that was
second. Yes, it did. That one finished second, yeah. And I think Linda's theme, I think, finished third. But anyway, you can check those all out on placebnation.com. Tonight, JR, we are not talking about WrestleMania by any stretch of the imagination. We are in October, the month of October of 1985. Two shows that month, JR. We'll have a show tonight, and we will have a show next Monday.
Mm-hmm.
But tonight, though, is not a house show.
We'll
do the house show. We'll do the house show next Monday at the Gadden. Tonight, though, we're down the pike. We left our cushy offices on 33rd Street, JR, and hopped down the parkway to Patterson Plank Road and the radio station slash
Road.
Club or whatever. Yeah. Yeah. And we are at the Meadowlands tonight, the Meadowlands Arena, I believe it was called at the time, in East Rutherford, New Jersey. I don't think it was technically Brendan Byrne Arena yet, and well before it became Continental Airlines.
Who was Brendan Byrne?
I think he was a former governor of New Jersey, I think. But I don't even think he was named it yet. I think
is
it was
buried
still
under the Meadowlands somewhere. Probably?
Yeah, I think he's in the other end zone with Jimmy Hoffa. But I believe at this point, still in late 85, I think it's still the old Meadowlands Arena, which is where we are tonight for the October 5th, 1985 episode of Saturday Night's Main Event. Our second one, JR, of course. The first one was way back in May. And this one, this one's interesting. Before we go any further, why don't we dive into the Sutton Report and Mr. Jarvis. I did not look and see if they – obviously this was taped. I don't know if there was an actual show that evening. I'm sure one of the two have it in there. So why don't we dive into our reports?
Have it in there. I believe – do you have the date that this was taped? Was it the 3rd?
I believe it was the – was it
can you
earlier
check
in the week? Yeah, I'll check Graham. Go ahead. Okay.
Yeah, because I wanted to look quick at what because Steven did put another card, but I think it was the night it was taped. So our championship roll call, our WWF champion, still Hulk Hogan, 619 days into his reign. Intercontinental champion, Tito Santana, 89 days into his. Tag team champion, still the Dream Team, 40 days into their reign. And Wendy Richter, still on top of the mountain of the women's division, 185 days. Other cards held on October 3rd, which I'm guessing was the day this was filmed, from Cleveland, Ohio Convention Center. Scott McGee fought to a draw with Les Thornton. That match working his way around the circle, apparently.
See, I told you!
Actually, this race kind of similar to the card we saw. Pedro Malice defeated Moondog Spots. Corporal Kirchner knocked off Steve Lombardi. Ricky Steamboat beat Don Morocco by DQ. The Hart Foundation beat the British Bulldogs. Randy Savage beat Tito Santana by countout. And the Junkyard Dog defeated Terry Funk.
And it was actually, it was 2 days before October 3rd. So it was taped on Thursday and aired on Saturday. But when we do our pop culture report later on in the show, we will treat it as if it's that Saturday.
So that card was like a stripped down version of the really good one we got last week.
Yes. Yes.
The one
in fact, I think Scott McGee and Les Thornton actually went last on that. I think they went to curfew.
Yes. They're still fighting.
They're still European uppercutting each other at 3 o'clock
somewhere
in the morning.
Yeah, somewhere in the world, they're still battering each other with uppercuts and chin locks.
Chin locks, yes. So there you go. But this was taped on Thursday the 3rd and aired on Saturday the 5th. They were only a 1 day difference more than the last time. The first one that aired on the 11th, but was taped on the 10th. Of May back at Nassau. This one is just another day. As we go forward, JR, we'll notice that the gap gets a little wider. Sometimes they tape almost 2 weeks beforehand. So, all right. Why don't we begin? Right out of the gate, the World Wrestling Federation Championship on the line, JR. Now, I have an interesting question, and I'll talk more about this. Next time we have Kelly on, I want to talk to him about this, because obviously, you know, 619 days, he's still the king of the hill. But, and I'm curious about the thinking on this. That's why I'm looking forward to asking Kelly, but I'd like your opinion as well. Hulk Hogan, of course, is about to defend the World Wrestling Federation Championship against the Russian Nikolai Volkov in a flag match. But in the I won't even count WrestleMania. In the 9 house shows we've done so far, how many has he been on?
4? 2, I think. No. Well, he had the whole 3 with Morocco.
Yeah, the 3 with Morocco. But after those 3, maybe 1? If you count the one in War to settle the score.
Right. That was it. I think that's the three with Morocco. I think that's all.
And then Mania. So if you take Mania out of the way, because that's a specialty show, he's been on less than half the MSG house shows. Perplexing.
Well, I think it seemed like a lot of time he was elsewhere.
Well, there's been a couple of times he was not on either show. He took our last one, the one in September, he had the month off. He wasn't at either show.
I mean, maybe he was doing PR or something. Yeah, I mean, he had to be doing something. You're right.
Yeah. So I was just curious because it's funny, and we'll see. Obviously, we have, what, 4 more to go. Wait, 3 more to go before the end of the calendar year. I have a feeling we'll see more of him in 1986, though. I think we'll see more of him on those in 86. Just curious. Just my opinion. But
Before you do get to that, I just want to bring up there were some dark matches on this evening.
Oh, okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Adrianus defeated our buddy Steve Gatorwolf. Iron Sheik knocked off Rick McGraw, the quick draw. King Tonga defeated Barry O, and Bob Orton Jr. defeated SD Jones, and the man with the big button and smile himself, David Sammartino, knocked off Tiger Chung Lee. So there you go.
No. Okay, so it's not Tiger Lee. It's not his cousin, Tiger Lee Chung.
No, it's not Tiger Lee.
Speaking of, I gotta
Tiger
plug this
Ali
again.
Chung.
Tiger Ali Chung. I want to say this again because I feel like we plug it a lot, and that's because it's a fantastic show. I'm actually 4 episodes into the Titans of Wrestling, listening to the fantastic
catalog. The show might not have got canceled if you listened to it when it was on. We wouldn't have had to kill it due to the ratings, you know?
I got these first few in, but I'm listening to them again. And episode 4 yesterday I was listening to, and that, I think it was July and August of 1979. The reason I'm bringing it up, JR, is because you brought up Adrian Adonis. For anybody that listened to the show, the 5 gentlemen, Parv, James, Sorrow, Kelly, and Pete, not the biggest Chief J. Strongbow fans. And they Parv referred to that awesome TNT that we watched, where they're doing the fucking dance out in the parking lot,
and those two
assholes are in their Cadillac throwing beer cans at them. Oh, it was so tremendous! But I had to bring it up because I remember that's one of our favorite episodes that we did on the Network Adventure.
For sure.
They trash Cheap J Strongbow. But anyway, I just wanted to bring that up.
Yeah, Parv hates Strongbow.
Yeah, they all did. This is one of the few guys that Sorrow actually did not like, because he pretty much liked everybody else in the whole fucking promotion, down to Moose Monroe or one of the jobbers.
Before you actually get to the match, too, there's I just wanted to talk about the open, because we do have a bit of a cold open before we get to the match. So we open with Mean Gene chatting with Nikolai Volkov and Freddie Blassie in the aisle. They're setting up tonight's big title match, and they talk about tensions between the United States and Russia. We then get a real quick promo from Hulk Hogan as well. That's followed by Gene talking to Hillbilly Jim and Uncle Elmer, preparing for a big wedding that's coming tonight, Scott, as Elmer will actually be wrestling and getting married tonight on the show. Yeah, Elmer is a man on a mission, and then Roddy Piper comes in and makes some jokes as we head to the open.
Thank God.
After the animation, we get Vince and Jesse opening the show, running down the card. Jesse rips on the wedding and says it has no business being on the show here tonight. So we're back here, second signings main event, Vince and Jesse in the booth, and pretty much setting out for our regular non-summertime schedule, which is a monthly replacing Saturday's main event, Saturday Night Live once a month.
Yes. Yep. And so there's our open and 85. Let's see. That was kind of like the black hole of Saturday Night Live, but they were still kind of trying to restructure. They go through some ugly years in the mid 80s.
When was the Ebersol era? Before, you know, when Lauren Michaels left for a bit.
It might be right around here. It might even be mid. I think it's around this time, because everybody left. 1980 was the bad year, because honestly, the only jewel in the first half of the decade was Eddie Murphy. The rest of the Joe Piscopo and some of these other fucking clowns, they were terrible after Chevy left and Bill left and Gilda and Aykroyd and, you know, Garrett Morris and like the the who's who from 75 to 79.
So 1980 is when Lorne stepped down.
Yes.
And then I'm trying to see.
I forgot their names. These other two people took over. And
Ebersol. I mean, Ebersol pretty much took over as the executive producer.
But they had new writers. I remember they had fresh writers because, honestly, Chevy was doing a lot of the writing the first few years before he went and did movies. And
I'm pretty sure Lorne would have been back, man. It doesn't say, but I'm pretty sure he was. I'm pretty sure Lorne was only gone for a short time.
Yeah. Well, you're looking at – well, we continue. I'm going to look up because I'm trying to figure out – I want to see when the first year – because then the renaissance came when, you know, Carvey and Kevin Nealon and Dennis Miller and Victoria Jackson, Jan Hooks, like that whole class. And then they dominated for the next, like, 7 years. Phil Hartman. So – but anyway, we'll talk about that in a little bit. But now, JR, as mentioned, we open – did you like this concept? They kind of did it. They did it in the first episode, almost like a house show where – you want to have the, you know, you want to have the fresh match early. You don't want to have the title match
it,
you know.
I loved it because it showed, I mean, right. I mean, I think that's the thinking behind it, right? You want to, you know, many times you have the main event last because you want people to stick around. But on a show like this, at a time slot like this, not many people are probably making it to 1 a.m, so at least on the East Coast. So, I mean, you want to have Hogan or your big gun come out first because you may have people that are turning or watching the news or expecting Saturday Night Live that may leave the TV on for a minute. You kind of want your big gun, your ace, your most well-known star, your most engaging star to be the first guy you see. So I think it was smart, since the show is still in its, you know, infancy, to, again, people that may have turned on. This is the first time they really replaced Saturday Night Live, I think, right? Because back in May, I mean, I don't think they did. I feel like SNL was probably done for the year.
Well, I'm looking at it now, and SNL actually hadn't started yet. The first episode of Saturday Night Live that season, 85-86, was on November 9th, so it hadn't even started yet.
So maybe for this one, you at least have people that are, you know, watching the news, 11 o'clock news or whatever, and stick around. So anyway, my whole point is, I think it's great to fire out of the gate with your biggest star here. A, because you got people that aren't going to make it, they're not going to stay up. And B, you're really trying to reach a brand new audience on this network, and you haven't been on it since May, so there is some lag. Yes, I mean, people might have forgotten about it. So I think coming out with your ace was a real smart move. So I think showcasing Hogan out of the gate was the way to go.
Yes, and here was the cast for that season, and this was definitely a transition bunch. Joan Cusack, John's brother, Robert Downey, Nora Dunn, Anthony Michael Hall, John Lovitz, Dennis Miller, Randy Quaid, Terry Sweeney, who was the first ever openly gay cast member, and that's notable for one reason, and Denitra Vance. And then they had, you know, some guests. Damon Wayans actually came in and out that year.
So Ebersol actually, he ran it till 85. So this was the first scene where – so Lorne left, and then Gene Domanian, maybe who you're thinking of.
Domanian, yeah. She was – I think it was a she.
She Ebersol produced it for a year. It was November 80 to March 81 was her run. And then Ebersol took over until 85, and that's when Lorne came back. So I think this may – I mean, the one that's coming up in November might have been Lorne's first one back. I don't know if he came back mid-season. I'm guessing he probably started the season fresh.
Well, it says here Ebersol left after the previous season, but when the network refused his request to shut the program down entirely for 6 months and shift much of the material onto tape, not live. Once again, NBC briefly considered canceling the show, but programming head Brandon Tartikoff, who liked the show, decided to continue on and rehire Lorne. In some ways, the job Michaels returned to was more challenging than the one he took on. For starters, Michaels' Golden Boy reputation was somewhat tarnished. His most recent effort the previous season's The New Show confused critics, was ignored. And it was the 84-85 season had been a critical ratings hit, generating memorable characters and standout performers. I think that's when Eddie Murphy started doing Mr. Robinson's Neighborhood and Gumbymon and that kind of stuff.
And he left in 84. So,
yeah. The first episode, just to look ahead, the first episode was Madonna. She was the host, actually.
Yeah.
And Simple Minds.
I recommend that book that came out. It was like the history of SNL, like the oral history or whatever.
Live from New York, the uncensored history of Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, it's an excellent book. I mean, it really dives deep into everything. Yep. A lot of, you know, covers those Ebersol years and covers all the problems and trials and tribulations and cast members. It's really an excellent book if you've never read it. It's probably fairly cheap, I would think, on Amazon, especially if you click through the placementnation.com link to get there. But anyway, it's not a Saturday Night Live podcast, so why don't we move on to our opener here.
Might be in the pop feed.
That's right. We can get to that later. Which is Hulk Hogan battling Nikolai Volkoff for the WWF title. Of course, the big Russia versus U.S. Feud going on here. The Americans were spying around, getting ready for a season. The next season comes up tomorrow, Scott, actually, of the Americans. Big heat on Nikolai Volkov during the Russian national anthem, as always, gets the crowd all revved up. Hogan again chats quickly with Gene in the aisle and puts over his love for the USA and then enters to a huge pop when Hogan comes out to Stars and Stripes Forever for this special occasion. Jesse notes that all Iron Curtain wrestlers are well-schooled, right as Nikolai jumps Hogan before the bell. Nikolai clobbers Hulk around the ring, yanking Hogan's shirt off and choking him with it. Hulk makes a quick comeback, leveling Nikolai with a clothesline and a flurry of right hands before another clothesline and an elbow drop. Hulk lays in some headbutts and a right hand as Jesse notes that the headbutt is new to Hogan's arsenal. Hulk kicks Nikolai out of the ring, and then he lands on the timekeeper's table as he falls out. Hogan follows him out and hammers away, but Nikolai is able to shove Hogan into the ring post to kill his momentum. Back inside, Nikolai kicked away and followed an axe blow off the middle rope and a big press slam backbreaker for two. After a few more blows, Hogan blocked a pile driver with a backdrop and then started to make his comeback, but Nikolai was able to cut it off with a thrust and some kicks. Vince calls Nikolai a master of roughhouse tactics as he stomps away, but Hogan quickly hulks up and slugs back. Nikolai reverses a whip to the corner but whiffs on a charge, and Hogan finishes him with a leg drop for a solid win. After the bell, Hogan shines his boots and spits on the shines his boots with and then spits on the Russian flag and waves the U.S. flag to close out the match. This was actually pretty spirited. I thought both guys hustled. They landed some good heavy blows. I thought it was a perfect showcase for Hogan and the title. Nikolai's credible enough to hang here, but he's also, you know, can easily take a loss. It doesn't really hurt him. So I thought he was a strong foil. You get the jingoistic stuff out of the way. You know, hook any new newer fans that may be tuning in. So this is a strong dressing opener. I went star and a half. I mean, you know, Scott, we reviewed every Saturday Night's Main Event last year. We know it's a rare when you hit a real hard match quality, but that wasn't always the goal for this show. So a star and a half for something like this to open things up for the WWF title, I think that was like perfectly acceptable for what they were looking for. 517 is really just a Hulk Hogan's greatest hit situation. What did you think of this one?
I gave it 2 stars. I thought it was perfectly fine TV fare. You know, Nikolai was a big heel challenger for Bruno and Pedro and Backlund in the mid to late 70s. Jesse's pretty much full heel now. He was kind of down the middle in May. Now he's pretty much the Jesse we love. I mean, the big heel segment, it worked out well. Yeah, the big heel segment, the choking, power strikes. Hogan still did not, you know, he still kind of rotated his ensemble, all white for this one, all white tights, white knee pads, white boots. It would be at least probably till the middle of 86 before he went full-blown red and yellow. Crowd's crazy, good Meadowlands crowd. It was smart for Vince to put the first two Saturday Night's Main Events in hotbeds. You don't want to have a show, you know, if you're trying to continue having a good
audience. I feel
like
everything is a hotbed at this point. I don't know. I know the home arenas, but I feel like, I mean, Hogan and crew is so red hot. I feel like any arena probably would have been pumped for this card. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I get the general point. It was smart to be in your home base for these.
Yeah, but I mean, you're right. I mean, they could have been like in Florida or something, which they would be very soon, as a matter of fact. They would branch out. I mean, they had no problem branching out, and they would be fine. But it didn't hurt to be right in the backyard. The shadow of New York City, as Vince would say. Vince still struggles with calling the moves. Like at one point, Nikolai is clearly going for a pile driver. Vince calls it a backbreaker. He still does like nonsense crap like that. I really like Nikolai in this match. He showed his power off. You know, Hogan's not a small guy to chuck around, and Nikolai really held his end of the bargain. And you know, 517 is a perfectly acceptable length for a match like this, a TV match like this. And I gave it 2 stars. You know, I'm kind of like you. As much as I despise communism, I always did like the hammer and sickle flag.
Yes.
So I was bummed to see it have it, you know, had it wiped. But you know, the flag doesn't reflect my opinions of the government. But it was a cool flag. But and the Americans is a great show. I've caught a couple of episodes. I got to watch it from the beginning. And it was just a good match. You know, jump on the whole Cold War bandwagon. You know, Reagan and Gorbachev still meeting, so still icy but warming up. So they needed to get as much out of it as they could at that point. And solid match, 2 stars, good way to open the show, crowd hot, ready to rock and roll. So there you go. Hulk Hogan retains the World Wrestling Federation Championship. All right, next, JR, we go backstage to our bride-to-be, Joyce. She's prepping for her wedding, coming later in the show. Yes. I do like that Jesse goes, is that really Off-White? The fucking asshole.
And in addition to that, though, actually before, we have Gene again talks to Hogan for a third time of the night. Yep. Discusses how the champ backed up his words in the ring, and then Hogan gives some final thoughts on the win and hypes up the wedding. He says he'll be part of that. And then, yeah, Gene talks to the Hillbillies and Elmer as well. Says he isn't worried about the wrestling or the wedding. Hillbilly calls Elmer the best wrestler in the WWF, and Cousin Junior confirms he will be dancing at the wedding tonight. So
and he won't be wearing shoes. I do like the double
as well.
Yes, I do like the double entendres though. Actually, Bobby does it later, but I think Gorilla just said you're going to be playing the keyboard, and I think what did Mean Gene say? We playing my organ or something like that?
Yeah,
they say that. There's like a whole. We'll get to it later on in the show because there's like entendres all over the place.
Yeah, he's like,
that,
I hope you'll be playing your big organ. Yeah, so yeah, playing your organ during the
Your organ tonight.
There's a lot of that during these shows for sure.
Oh yeah. Oh, there's no doubt. They were having a blast, and you know, only the older fan. Like we had no idea what they were saying, but the older fans definitely got it. So. All right, next up, JR, speaking of Uncle Elmer, the groom-to-be, he is in the ring because I know you've been waiting for this one because work rate galore for this one. Taking on a guy, this is a Parv special right here, another guy that was mentioned often in the early episodes of Titans of Wrestling. Tell us who his opponent is.
His opponent is John Hill, otherwise known as Jerry Valiant, Canadian wrestler from Hamilton, Ontario, began his career in 1959 in Canada. Moved to the U.S. in 1960, where he wrestled under the name Guy Hill. It might be Guy, but I prefer to think it's Guy. Like,
no, I think it is Guy. I think Guy's better.
Like Guy Germain, the Mighty Ducks. During his career in the 60s and 70s, he wrestled throughout the U.S., Canada, and Australia under various names, including Guy Mitchell, the Destroyer, and the Stomper.
Guy Stomper.
Came to WWF in 1979 as Jerry Valiant. At the time, Jimmy Valiant had contracted hepatitis. It's like the least surprising thing ever. And a new family member was needed to team with Johnny. So the duo won the tag team championship. And when Jimmy recovered, the three wrestled in six-man tag matches. Jerry Valiant left the territory in 1980 to continue his solo career elsewhere. Returned here in 1984 as a referee and low-card wrestler. And, of course, he is battling the man who we talked about last week, big ol' Uncle Elmer, with a showcase squash to set up the wedding for later tonight. This made me laugh. Vince calls Jerry Valiant a big city slicker, which made me laugh.
The big city slicker.
Jesus Christ. Like right out of The Big Short or something, you know what I mean? Like, oh, that big city slicker coming down here selling us all those reverse mortgages. Valiant actually had a solid look still. Surprised they didn't utilize him more at this point, honestly. The Hillbilly Brigade marches out, and Junior does a stupid asinine jig followed by all three square dancing. The bell then rings, and Elmer scoops Valiant up and slams him to the mat for the easy win. And he actually sets a record, Scott, with that win at 6 seconds, shattering King Kong Bundy's record, of course. I love Vince, who's like, our preliminary reports are being confirmed by the Fink right now. A new record is set. Jesse reminds us that first one was 9 seconds from Mania, and it's still absurd that they're clinging to that 9 seconds because they show the clip. It is clearly not 9 seconds. Like, they're saying it's 9 seconds as the clip is airing. That's like 30 seconds.
But, I know.
But anyway, that I wonder if they did it just to get rid of that fakeness. But anyway, that's done. Elmer has a new record. Nothing to see here besides the nonsense of Elmer and I guess the setting of the record. But I don't know. Did you think Valiant actually had like a decent enough look that he could have maybe done a little bit more at this point, or was he just job fodder?
I don't know. I kind of dug his hair. He had the nice jacket. Come on, man. He's the city slicker.
Billy Crystal, the city slickers.
That's right. Great movie. Jack Palance. I mean, he was fine. I mean, he seemed like an older guy, kind of fit that like Paul Christie mold or some of those other older jobbers that would show up at the Garden. I don't know. Did Vince mention? I don't remember. Did Vince say he was a former tag team champion? I don't think so, right? I think he just said he was I think his moniker was just he was a city slicker.
I'm surprised too. Isn't Jerry Valiant? Oh, that was Jerry Graham was his big guy, but the Valiants he was like a big fan of too, right? Vince growing up or whatever. So
they were one of the
gush more of them.
Yeah, no, that's one of his big teams that his dad put together. Look, Jimmy getting hepatitis. What a fucking shock. I wonder where that came from.
God knows how he got it.
There are plenty of pigs at the reception. I mean, there's nothing more to see. This is a dud. It's trash. I mean, whatever. You got to put Uncle Elmer over. You know, he's like the bigger main event than
he's
fucking
the best
Hogan
wrestler
tonight.
In the world, according to Hillbilly Jim. Gene then catches up with the Hillbillies and confirms the record as Elmer says Valiant should have never taken his daggone coat off. That's Elmer's big catchphrase there. His daggone coat. And it's funny because on top of all this, I still think Junior is the one I hate the most. Just that stupid fucking dancing just annoys me more than anything.
It's so bad. It's so bad. Where they do the little, hey, little hoedown going on. Oh, God. That place must have stunk. But the combination of pig shit and Junior's feet. That place smelled like a fucking locker room. Anyway, we have an excellent addition, JR, of kind of the alternative heel interview show to the awesome Piper's Pit. We don't see it very often. I don't know if this was a superstar. It was a challenge show, but it was the Body Shop.
Yes, it was. The Body Shop, indeed. Jesse the Body Ventura is the host of The Body Shop, mm-hmm. and he comes out to the ring and brings out Bobby Heenan, and they discuss how Heenan made Paul Orndorff a star before Mr. Wonderful fired him. Heenan said he was going to fire Orndorff anyway, and they discuss the bounty on Paul's head. Bobby has raised that bounty from $25,000 to $50,000 and says this makes it easier to get someone to take him up on the offer. Heenan says it would be his pleasure to give Piper the money if he is successful tonight. Gene backstage then talks to Orndorff, who calls out Heenan and says Piper isn't man enough to collect the bounty. Gene says Piper's already started to spend the money, and Paul says he's spending it on more dresses. Gene then talks to Piper, who says he's going to take out Orndorff and rip out Heenan's throat if he doesn't pay him, because Gene notes that, oh, you know, who knows if he'll actually pay you if you do it. Piper makes fun of Orndorff wearing baby oil and says he'd take out his own grandmother if he could get $50,000, and wraps things up by making fun of the wedding and the potential for possible Little Elmers. So, there you go there, Scott. What did you think of the Body Shop?
I liked it a lot. I think Jesse is awesome. Just as awesome a interview show as Piper's Pit. I kind of liked Bobby's swank what is that, like Pierre Cardin briefcase or yes. whatever the hell it was. That was pretty
briefcases
awesome.
At this point. We got Trudy, we got the bounty briefcase, we got a lot going on.
Very very nice. No Halliburton. No Halliburton, baby. So yeah, it was a good segment. I enjoyed it. I love bounty storylines. I mean, obviously it goes back to Harley and Flair in 83, but I love bounty storylines. They're pretty awesome.
What do you think of the Body Shop as a gimmick? Like, did you think it was one of the better ones at the time? Because I feel like we don't see a ton of it, and I think it just gets overshadowed because Piper's Pit was so big and popular this time. I mean, Jesse's obviously great, but did you think he was good in that role, or was he better suited for where he was in the booth? Did you like him in that interview stuff?
I did. I think he was a good – again, I think Piper's Pit obviously was the more exemplary show, but here's the difference. I mean, you know, Piper was a active competitor, whereas, you know, Jesse was just a heel commentator. So he had to kind of not use his own his own athletic ability to kind of put over a storyline, whereas with Jesse, he could just be there and, you know – kind of stir the pot with other guys. So he had to take a different approach than Piper did, but still just an equally good show. I'm trying to remember if it was on more than other stuff. Like, I mean, I remember Piper on pretty much every Superstars. I mean, maybe I don't remember who was, you know? Not as often, that's for sure.
No, definitely not as often.
I mean, was it on house shows more? I mean, we haven't seen one on at the Garden yet, but yeah. I don't know. I thought it was fine. Again, it was a different approach because Jesse was not an active competitor. He kind of had to help, you know, others. He had to kind of help. He kind of stirred the pot between in other storylines, whereas Piper pretty much engaged his own storylines to help with it. So I had no problem with it. Speaking of the bounty, JR, that is our next match.
I was trying to see if Wikipedia had anything on the different talk shows, but I don't see like a simple link to it, because you know, some of these other sites I know on Letters from Kayfabe, Parv and Allen went through them all on one episode, so they might have talked about it more on there.
I see,
off the top of my head, but anyway, but there was I don't know how often he was on, if he was on a certain show or not. I mean, he announced Superstar, so you think it would be there, so maybe it was just when Piper's Pit wasn't, but anyway. Yes, we do have our next match, Scott. That is Roddy Piper taking on Paul Orndorff, looking to cash in that bounty. This red-hot feud continues. We saw an awesome match between them a couple months ago at MSG, and it's still raging on. Orndorff really fired up as he hits the ring. Piper gets the full Emerald Society entrance here to set the stage. Mm-hmm. Bobby Heenan comes out with a briefcase full of cash and holds it up. And after a break, the two men wildly start brawling and trading fists. Orndorff wins the initial battle until Piper cracks him with a clothesline and a boot to the gut before spiking his head to the mat over and over. Orndorff comes back with some right hands before it degenerates into a street fight with both men rolling around and clawing and punching at each other. Piper lands a DDT and a running boot to the head before things spill to the floor. The two men then brawl outside using a chair and table before heading back in, where Orndorff clobbers Piper off the top rope and hits a back suplex. Jesse notes that the suplex is the first wrestling move of the match. The rest has all been brawling. Orndorff kept firing away until Piper goes to the eyes and buries a knee lift. Both men would collide and collapse, with Piper recovering first and choking away. Orndorff comes back with punches and then wildly dives at Piper with a flying body press that took both men over the top to the floor. They brawl outside there and all the way to the back as the match ends in a double countout. The camera follows them backstage, and Piper eventually ducks into a locker room. I thought this was an awesome brawl. It's about as exciting as a four-minute match as you'll see during this era. I thought the passion fire was tremendous. The existing bad blood and the bounty money on the line adds all to it. The tension was palpable. I think you toss in a great performance by Jesse and Vince here, really amping things up. The crowd is red hot. And I think of the two Saturday Night's Main Events we've watched so far, this is my favorite segment. I went 2.5 on this one, Scott, which is saying something since it was a 4-minute brawl with a non-finish. But it was that hot and that much fun.
Yeah. I gave it 2 stars. I just wish it was longer. But unfortunately, we had to deal with
but I feel like the intensity was so great that even if they went a few minutes longer, it might have dulled just a bit. Like, that 4 minutes was just, like, filled with such fury. I didn't mind. Of course, I'd like to see them wrestle for longer, but I feel like they actually hit the sweet spot with that match.
Yeah, no, they did. And Jesse was fantastic. They brawl into the hallway. I continue to like the Piper. You know, ducks and hides in a cool way. It's like, well, why is he hiding? Is he a coward? No, he's just smart because it's Piper. You know, anybody else would be a coward. He's not. So I thought that was very cool. Bobby's bounty really didn't play into any of this. Would Orndorff winning have made it even better? Or are you happy that it ended up just being inconclusive? Did it matter to you?
No. No, he didn't need to win. The brawl is what matters. They're just trying to beat the shit out of each other. Neither guy cares if they win. I mean, Piper's trying to cash the bounty, so he doesn't really care if he wins anyway. And Orndorff's just trying to survive and then get revenge. So I think it's fine. It's one of those feuds. I mean, it's a time in wrestling where they did stuff like this more and more to protect different guys, and I think here it's perfectly acceptable. Plus, I don't think they were ready to end the feud yet. I think they still had plans for it.
It definitely had juice still.
We'll also see, too, that Piper kind of had to be protected because coming up quickly for us, Scott is a big match for him. So I think I think you had to protect Piper. You can't have Orndorff lose here. So I think this was perfect. I don't think the fans felt like they're probably disappointed at all because they just went, you know, bananas as these guys beat the shit out of each other. So it was a lot of fun. They really made those 4 minutes count, and I was perfectly fine not having a finish there.
Yeah, no, it's fine. I was just curious. It was a great brawl. It really worked well, and the crowd was fired up. So these first two nights, these first two matches, crowd is pretty pumped up. Unfortunately, I feel like the steam just kind of goes out of the building after this moment, to be honest with you. Why don't we take a break? Okay. Early on here, because, you know, not exactly a long show. Obviously, so far, JR, match-wise, I mean, serving its purpose, 2 for 2. We've had two, you know, pretty solid short sprints, no?
2 out of 3. Elmer and...
I forgot about that. Well, that's quite forgettable. I thought Hogan Volkoff was a lot of fun, and this match was certainly
honestly, if you're not biased against Elmer like we are, you're probably 3 for 3 because it was effective in making Elmer look like a beast. Yes, a figurative and literal beast.
Yes.
It was effective in that you're trying to make him seem like he's really, really good, and, you know, him just killing Valiant before getting married is effective. So, I mean, I'd argue 3 for 3. It's just the fact that it's wasted on Elmer.
Exactly. True. All right, when we come back, more hillbilly fun, and I believe we have a tag title match on the line later on in the show as well. But first, let us take a powder with the City Snicker. Because...
Promotional consideration paid for by the following. voice of Ring of Honors, Kevin Kelly here. I just want to make sure you're all subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Now, it's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search for and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed, Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, Pro Wrestling Only Feed, and, of course, the Kevin Kelly Show Feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And, of course, as always, enjoy all the great action of Ring of Honor Wrestling and everything presented to you on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we offer them to you across two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast with our famous vintage wall pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with the smash hit Clotheslines and Headlines, our steady veteran main event, and the beloved monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on all pro wrestling super shows. Relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the always contentious Dangerous Alliance podcast, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. On our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, NBA Team, Lucha Undead, Geek and Sassy, and a veritable podcast heaven for comic fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both of those feeds on iTunes and rate and leave feedback for us as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on the right-hand side of our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The PWO PTBN feed has changed its name, now known simply as Pro Wrestling Only, so it should be easier to find and indeed to say. All of your favorite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more, including our full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
We are back taking a look at the second Saturday Night's Main Event from October 5th, 1985. And Scott, I want to cherish these moments. Who knows how many podcasts we have left together in the tank? You know, we've been through 440 of them after tonight. We need to keep these moments close to our heart and enjoy each and every one of them, just like Kool and the Gang. Cherish you and cherish their love. And they were, Scott, the number two song in the nation this week. And the reason, you know, we usually play the number one song coming out of break, but it still was the same song that we heard last episode, and that was the September 23rd, 85 house show. So a couple weeks before was Dire Straits' Money for Nothing. That was the number one song. So Kool and the Gang, we go with the number two song for this week to play us in. And Scott, that means it is time for the Criscolo Pop Culture Corner. So why don't you bring us in?
All right. Pretty loaded loaded report this week, JR. Fortunately, get your Wikipedia ready because there's a boatload of movies for you to look up. As JR mentioned, since it is a Saturday, the Billboard Top 100 for the week came out that day, and Dire Straits, Sting, and the MTV Noises. Still at the top, Money for Nothing from
Man
Brothers in
Called
Arms.
Sting.
Brothers in Arms, great album, 1985. That's number one, as you hear, Cherish the Love We Had, as you're, you know, getting your teeth, you know, fluoridated or whatever. Fluoride loaded. Cherish by Kool and the Gang at number two. Number three.
Did you ever think you'd play Cherish by Kool and the Gang on this show, by the way? Is that something you ever expected to hear?
Precisely. That's because it is a tremendous yacht rock song, even though it's a little bit later on in the...
Doesn't make the cut. I don't believe it. By the way, my daughter, what's up with that? Not into Georgie Porgy.
Fixed. Come on, JR. You gotta up the...
She was like angry about it. Aggressively angry.
Musical parenting skills. Come on.
And my son just sat there and goes, what's this song? And I'm like, well, it's a good song. And she's like, no, turn it off. So, of course, I turned it up. And that's what led to the iconic picture that was put on social media over the weekend. But
yes, it was very funny. We have to work on that. What was the song he cried to? There was one song last year during St. Mary's weekend. Remember it came on and he was bawling his eyes out?
No, not George Benson. It was...
Yeah, it was Cruising. That.
Yeah, is that Benson, though?
Yeah, it's George Benson.
Okay.
Cruising.
Yeah, that was the one.
That was bawling his eyes out.
I don't hear that one much anymore. I feel like they phased it out.
They did phase it out. I think they played a little more, what was that? Turn Your Love Around.
And Give Me the Night, that one too. That's a.
And Give Me the Night. Yes, that is George Benson, yes. Number three, Ready for the World, Oh Sheila. Oh Sheila. Number four, Little Take on Me by Aha.
Mm-hmm.
At number five, the host of the first Saturday Night Live that season, Madonna with Dress You Up. I'm gonna dress you up in my love. Number six, Whitney, moved up three spots with Saving All My Love for You. Number seven, dropping four spots, Freedom by Wham, probably their last single.
Wham.
Number eight, I think this guy, the first time we talked about him, JR, little John Mellencamp, Lonely All Night. It's a lonely all night. Moved up two spots from 8 to 10 to 8. Going into the top 10 at number nine, Dancing in the Street. It says Mick Jagger, but it was a duet. It was Mick Jagger and David Bowie. And then number 10, little Part-Time Lover. Stevie Wonder moved up five spots to number 10. So there's your top 10.
It's our Mentos song. When he comes out to coach, they play that.
That's right. He's like fucking Luther. Not Luther. He's Luther. He's definitely not Bumper. He's definitely Luther.
No, well, yeah, so he's... Yes, he's Luther.
So there's your top 10 for that day, October 5th, 1985. All right, JR. Time for you to get the wiki ready. Mm-hmm. Six movies came out day before. Two of them made an exorbitant amount of money, and one of them, JR, the star of the movie, we actually saw in the crowd at this Saturday Night's main event.
Hmm.
So we'll start at the bottom, though. Making an incredible $2,357. RSV the movie. No.
Wish.
To make 20 times. I know. I'll even take that.
Right. Jesus.
Take that and some fucking phone cards. The movie is called, it's a drama. It must be a foreign film. It's called Oberst Rettel. OBER. Here, spell it out. OBEST space REDL. Sounds Russian.
Let's see. Yes, German is Oberst Rettel. Colonel Rettel is the... it doesn't look like a fun... The poster is a guy in a military outfit with like fire burning behind him, so I don't know. It's Alfred Rettel, a Ruthenian boy from Galicia in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, wins an appointment to a prestigious military academy in spite of being the son of a mere peasant farmer. So, there you go.
And then he sets everybody on fire?
I don't know. I don't want to spoil it. Starring Klaus Maria Brandeur, Hans Christian Bleck, Armin Muller-Stahl, Gudrun Langrib, Italian Kubanini, Jean Nicholas, Laszlo Monsaros, Andres Balint, Laszlo, two Laszlos, Galfili.
I like Laszlo Armento. I think that's what we should start calling him.
Dorotea Udvaros, Karoli Epergis, Robert Rattoni, and Flora Kada.
Sounds like a bunch of guys in the Montreal promotion. Like a Pat Patterson faction right there. All right. So there you go. At number five,
it's a hot movie,
this movie, another drama, made $8,905. The drama is called Came a Hot Friday.
Okay.
Starring Cock Robin.
Yes. New Zealand-made comedy film based on the 1964 novel. In rural New Zealand in 1949, Wes Pennington and his partner Cyril are out on a run to run a horse racing scam for as long as they can. They're inveterate gamblers who have joined forces to trick local bookies, taking advantage of delayed broadcasts of horse races. Starring Peter Bland, Philip Gordon, Michael Lawrence, and Billy T. James.
Not Billy D. Williams, Billy T. James.
Yes.
At number four, making $38,493, another drama, morbid weekend. This one is called, I think I've heard of this one, though, Dream Child.
Let's see what Dream Child is all about.
It's not Nightmare on Elm Street Part 5, The Dream Child. It's just Dream Child.
Is it one word, two words?
One word.
Okay, let me try one more. This is a two words. Okay, here we go. A 1985 British drama written by Dennis Potter. The story is told from the point of view of an elderly Alice as she travels to the United States to receive an honorary degree from Columbia University, celebrating the centenary of Lewis Carroll's birth. So there you go. Starring Coral Brown, Peter Gallagher. Isn't that, what's his name? Yes, it is. From the OC.
That's right, yes. That's right. Right, the father or whatever?
Yeah, what's he say? My father's the... Her father's the district attorney, whatever the fuck the line was. Ian Holm, Jane Asher, Nicola Cowper. That's about it. Nothing else. Oh, there's puppeteers involved as well. Big Mick as the Mad Hatter. Ron Mook.
Puppeteers!
That's his name, Big Mick. Karen Prell, Michael Sedan, and Steve Whitmire are the puppeteers. I'm looking at Big Mick has his own wiki page.
Nice.
Mick Walter, often referred by the stage name as Big Mick, is an English actor known for appearing in television comedies and also appeared in Black Books, Green Wing, and Cycleville. Been on BBC adaptations. 2010, appeared in Ponto at the Alhambra Theater in Bradford as one of the Seven Dwarfs. So he is 1.19 meters in height.
Ah, so he's one of those. I see.
Before an actor, okay. He was a drummer as a three-piece band in Huddersfield. So Sir Stephen Sutton will provide much more information on him on our next
Yes, film. Yes. Yeah, so it's kind of an Alice in Wonderland, kind of brought to life. Very interesting.
Big Nick.
All right, at number three, this movie made $147,070. Another drama.
Mm.
This one is called The Doctor and the Devils. No, which makes sense.
It was a doctor and the doctor's women, or whatever that one was. Dr. T and the women.
Dr. T and the women. No, what's funny is Dr. G is a Devils fan, so it's not the Doctor and the Devils, but there you go.
Okay, hang on. So The Doctor and the Devils.
Yep.
Let's see what this is about. It's a gothic thriller produced by Mel Brooks production company Brooks Films, released in 1985. Dr. Thomas Rock, a respected 19th century anatomist, lecturing at a prominent middle school, deeply passionate about improving medical knowledge with a pursuit for which he believes the ends justify the means. Due to the laws at the time, very few cadavers were legally available, so they had to necessitate the use of grave robbers. Starring Timothy Dalton, Jonathan Pryce, Twiggy, Julian Sands, Stephen Ray, Patrick Stewart. So not a bad little cast here.
No, not at all.
Were you a Twiggy guy?
Twiggy. She was all right. She was okay looking.
I mean, it's, from what you hear, like, she was like the ace of the time, right? I mean, she was like an icon in Britain.
Yes, she was. She was.
60s.
She was a big – she was in a couple of Hitchcock films back in the day. So, no, she was very – she was very well known.
It's an unattractive name. Like, it doesn't make you get excited.
No, it makes you seem like you have anorexia or something. Right. I mean, I'm taking out Twiggy.
Right. I mean, it doesn't sound like a hot name. But
no, take her to the buffet.
Do you know her name she was born with?
Probably Julia or something.
Leslie Hornby.
Yeah, Leslie sounds like a British name. Hornby does, too.
Yes, it does.
All right, these next two are heavyweights right here.
She released an album in 2011, by the way, Twiggy.
She's still alive in 2011? I thought she passed away. No. Kind of like Judge Wapner.
She's 67, born 1949. So.
Oh, well, interesting.
She outlasted you.
Really? All right, number two, JR, big movie here. Made $10 million that first weekend and finished with $35,073,978.
Cock Robin.
Action film. What?
It's a Cock yeah. Robin.
Cock Rob, yeah. This guy was in the crowd at JR. Did you notice who was in the crowd at the Meadowlands that evening?
God. What match are we seeing during?
I'm trying to remember when. It was early on.
Okay.
I think it was in between Hogan and
I don't know. I don't have it noted here, so I won't remember.
The guy who's pimping Mobile Strike right now. Get it on the app. The governor.
Arnold
Schwarzenegger. Okay. Arnold was in the crowd. And
fired from The Apprentice.
Yes, he was. Or sad. I thought he quit.
That's not the word on the street that I see on Twitter.
Oh, boy.
The ratings drove him off the show. That's why he's leaving. Didn't you read the tweets? Sad.
I thought he quit because...
The ratings disaster.
Disaster.
I only get my news from Donald Trump's Twitter. So if it's not there, I don't buy it. So
that's right.
News.
Well, it's because it's all real. Well, Spicer would know. Yeah, he reads it on the back of a comic book. No, at number two, Commando.
Oh, wow. Look at that.
Commando. Our girl, Alyssa Milano. In Commando. Give us the official lowdown.
1985 American action film directed by Mark L. Lester, of course, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger and Ray Don Chong, released on October 4th. That came out that day. 90 minutes long, budget of $10 million, made $57.5 million.
Pretty good.
Ray Don Chong, Alyssa Milano, Vernon Wells. That's what he was doing before he started playing baseball.
That's right. That's before he took the juice and went to the Blue Jays.
Before he signed that ridiculous contract. James Olsen, right. David Patrick Kelly, Bill Duke, Dan Hedaya. He's the man, of course. We all know
Wasn't he Carla's husband? Was that Nick Tortelli?
Yeah, that's him. He's also in Clueless. He was the dad in Clueless,
right.
Of course.
So
he's been around. Rookie of the Year he was in. Mighty Ducks.
Right.
He's been around.
That's right.
If you've seen a movie between like 1979 and
2015,
2015, he's still making movies. Yeah, 16, he was one. Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, he was in.
He was in that? Yeah. Oh yeah, I think I saw him in the trailer.
He did six episodes of Yes Dear. He was in Mulholland Drive. So yeah, he's done. He's in Monk, episode of Monk, Gotham, Night at the Roxbury. Of course,
he was in. Yes, he was in Gotham. Yes, he was in Gotham.
He was the father, Butabi, in Night at the Roxbury. He's in Shaft, Judging Amy. Ransom, First Wives Club, Usual Suspects, Clueless, Nixon.
Like Joe Pantoliano. He just shows up in everything.
Everything. Adam's Family.
Really?
It was Tully Alford, whatever that is.
I don't remember him in the Adam's Family.
Who's the boss? Wise Guys?
Oh, so who's the boss? So we took... if Alyssa Milano says, if I'm in this movie, Dan Hedaya's got to be in it too.
13 episodes of The Tortellis he did, of course. Bill Paxton, Scott, was also in this movie.
Late Bill Paxton.
And Drew Snyder. So there you go. Retired Delta Force operator Colonel John Matrix, informed by his former superior Major General Franklin Kirby that all the other members of the former unit had been killed by unknown mercenaries. The mercenaries among them, Bennett, an Australian ex-member of Matrix's team, fired for excessive violence, attack Matrix's secluded mountain home, and kidnap his daughter, Jenny. Of course, on from there.
Mm-hmm.
Filming took 45 days on location in California.
Wow. Economically, 45 days. But it was not the highest moneymaker of the weekend, JR.
Oof, must have been something big.
Well, it's a movie I actually know about. It's one of those kind of mushy, it's not mushy, it's a thriller suspense film. Made $40,491,165. It is Jagged Edge.
Where the party at?
I know who's in it too. I kind of remember the plot a little bit.
Starring Glenn Close, Jeff Bridges, and Peter Coyote. it's a courtroom thriller.
Yes.
An intruder in a black mask and clothing ties up San Francisco socialite Paige Forrester at a remote beach house, kills her with a jagged-edged hunting knife, and writes the word bitch on her wall with blood. Her husband, Jack, later recovers in a clinic with a bloody head wound, claiming to have been knocked unconscious. After Paige's funeral, Jack is arrested by the DA for her murder based on evidence that includes witnesses at a club who saw the hunting knife in his locker. So there you go. Robert Loggia, also in that movie.
That's right. Yes, he was. Yep.
John,
I think he was a PI or something.
John Denver, not John Denver. Karen Austin, Guy Boyd, Marshall Colt.
Yes. How many geese do we have on the show?
Lance Henriksen, Lee Taylor Young. No one else really known. Michael Dorn, Bruce French.
Not Roger Dorn. Ole bullshit.
This made $40 million after a budget of $15 million. So there you go. More people were into this than Commando. Pretty surprising.
Like Commando. Well, I think... No, this actually came out before that. I'm trying to think. I thought maybe she was hot on the heels of Fatal Attraction, but that didn't come out for another couple of years. I don't know why this did so well.
Let me see what came out before this one.
What else was she in before this?
Ray Stroke, The Legend of Tarzan, Lord of the Apes, but she was on.
Oh, I remember that movie.
Stone Boy. Oh, The Natural.
That's right. She was in The Natural.
The Big Chill and The World According to Garp.
Oh, she was in The Big Chill. That's right. Okay, because this is about a couple of years before Fatal Attraction came out.
Yeah, that was 87.
All right, so there's your movies that came out the night before, the day before. So.
She's still making movies, too. There you go.
Oh, yeah. She definitely is. Yep. She was Cruella in the two Dalmatian movies.
She got six this year.
Yeah, and she's also on a very popular show called Damages.
Hmm.
That's on I think it was on NBC, and then it moved to like Netflix only or whatever. Kind of like what happened. It kind of had the same fate as Friday Night Lights. It did really well. It was like a cult show, but it, I don't know. The networks kind of blew it off, and it actually did very well. And now you can get it all on Netflix.
You dare compare any that garbage to Friday Night Lights?
Oh, Friday Night Lights is tremendous. All right. JR, this is the final weekend, sadly, of the Major League Baseball season, and as awesome as our teams did in 1985, neither of us going to the playoffs. The Yankees lost 5-1 to the Blue Jays, and the Mets lost 8-3 to the Expos. So pretty much all the divisions are wrapped up. The Blue Jays up 3 with 2 left, so congratulations. The Toronto Blue Jays win the AL East. The Yankees were very good, 96-64. I think they finished 98-64. The Mets, what a dogfight they had, but they will fall short as well. The Cardinals win the NL East. And the Royals clinch the West. They came from behind. They are 2 ahead of the Angels with 2 days left. And the Dodgers already clinched the NL West. So your final four are the Blue Jays, Royals, Cardinals, and Dodgers. And they will meet in the, well, they'll meet in the playoffs, and we'll see where we are in the playoffs, JR, next week on our next show. All right, it is, and I said we would do this on the next show. It is week number 5 of the NFL season for 1985. So what I'll do, JR, I'll give you the matchups. Kind of remember, keep 1985 teams and how good and bad they are in your head. Let me know who you think won these games for week 5. All right, ready? Niners at Falcons.
I'm just getting the music queued up. I'm sorry. Okay. Niners at Falcons. We're talking mid-80s. I'm going to say the Niners win that one.
Yes. 38-17. Joe Montana threw for 429 yards. Eagles at New Orleans.
Eagles at New Orleans. New Orleans is pretty much a dumpster fire in the 80s, so I'm going to go with Philly.
Saints won by 2, 23-21.
Bills
at Colts.
Fuck the Bills. I will take Indy in that one.
Indy rolled 49-17.
Fuck you, Buffalo.
Jim Kelly was not there yet. Good matchup here. Steelers at Dolphins.
Steelers at Dolphins. That's a good one. I'm going to go with Miami.
Miami wins 24-20. Dan Marino threw for 277 yards. Bears at Tampa Bay. This one should be easy.
Bears at Tampa Bay. Yes, that should be easy, the Bears.
Yes, they won 27-19 because they only lost one game and they hadn't done that yet. Even though Steve DeBerg threw for 346 yards in the loss for Tampa. That's a lot against that defense. The Patriots in Cleveland.
I will take the Pats in that.
No, Browns win 24-20.
Wow.
Yes, even though Tony Eason threw for 304 yards. The Lions at Lambeau to take on the Packers.
Green Bay.
Green Bay rolled 43-10.
Lions are fucking a bitch.
The Chargers head up to the Kingdom to take on the Seahawks.
Was Fouts still around at this point? I will take the Chargers.
But he did not start that day. Okay. Seahawks win 26-21.
So you didn't give me the true info there. That's not fair.
But Herman started and threw for 344 yards, which is about what he probably would have thrown for anyway. Your Jets, 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 Jets go into Cincinnati to take on the Bengals.
I'm going to say Cincy won that one.
No! Kenny O'Brien, 211 yards passing. Jets win 29-20.
Suck it, Boomer.
29-20. He wasn't even there yet. He was still in Maryland. I think Ken Anderson was still quarterback. Oh, no, maybe Boomer. No, I think Boomer was a senior that year. The Oilers go into Denver to play the Broncos.
I will take Houston in that one.
The Broncos win 31-20. John Elway threw for 256 yards. Vikings go into Anaheim to take on the Rams.
Minnesota.
The Rams win 13-10.
I started hot, falling apart.
Yes. The Chiefs go into the Coliseum to play the Raiders.
I will take the Raiders on that one.
The Raiders win 19-10. The Cowboys go to the Meadowlands to take on the New York Football Giants.
I will take the Giants.
The Cowboys win by a point, 30-29, even though Phil Simms threw for 432 yards. And finally, Monday night from RFK, the Redskins host the St. Louis Cardinals.
I will take Washington at home on Monday night.
Yes, the Redskins win 27-10. So there's your week 5. Not bad. Not bad, dog.
I think I did it right. It was about 500, I think. That's not bad.
Yeah, not bad at all.
Sitting on picking games that I've, you know, teams I've never seen. So it's a
5 years old.
Right.
College football that weekend, just the top 10 we'll give you. And a lot of upsets. Third-ranked SMU lost 28-6 to the Wildcats of Arizona. Number 10, Arkansas beat TCU 41-0. Number 8, LSU lost at home 20-0 to number 11, Florida. Fifth-ranked Ohio State lose at home at the Horseshoe to Illinois, 31-28. Number 1, Iowa beat Michigan State, 35-31. Number 7, Michigan win at Wisconsin, 33-6. Second-ranked Oklahoma blows out Kansas State in Manhattan, 41-6. And number 6, Oklahoma State wins at Tulsa, 25-13.
There you go.
And before we wrap up, earlier in the week, JR, there was a sad and kind of eye-opening death in the world of pop culture.
Mm.
On October 2nd, which was, that was the 5th, so that was a Wednesday, we lost one of the most legendary actors of of the early era back in the 50s, 60s, and acted all the way till his death. And that was Rock Hudson, who died at the age of 59. As it turned out, of course, Rock Hudson had AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
And this was – I remember being home because I remember I was playing football, and it was right before – I don't know if you – well, you were really young, but there was a hurricane that blew through the Northeast, JR, Hurricane Gloria. I'm sure it blew through Rhode Island as well.
Yeah, and I vaguely remember the name.
Yeah, we were off from school for quite a while. And the day before we were supposed to go back to school, I blew my knee out playing football. So I was out for a couple weeks, and I sat home and watched nothing but
baseball. Wait, so you were out for a couple weeks as you blew your knee out?
I blew my knee out, and they told me to the orthopedist at Yale told me that I needed to stay home for 2 weeks in a huge leg brace thing. It was annoying.
That sounds like not quite a blown-out knee. That seems like maybe like a tweak.
No, it was a tear.
I feel like you've been out more than 2 weeks. I think you're doing a show on Michaels. I think you were just going home.
I lost my smile. I didn't want to do my math homework. I lost my math smile. in any event, I was home, and this came up, and it was,
were you singing that as the hurricane blew through on your gimp knee? I think you just didn't want to play football in the hurricane.
No, I did want to play football. I actually got tackled on an interception. I picked off a pass and got tackled by the quarterback, and my cleat got stuck in the grass.
Was this actual? Wait. So was this high school?
No, I was in seventh grade. We were playing a game of pickup football.
Oh, I thought you were on a team somewhere.
No.
Who told you to stay home?
The doctor.
Oh, I think you said the team doctor made you stay home. I didn't know you played football.
No, seventh grade. I was in seventh grade. I was 13.
That all sounds 12. Made up.
No, I was 12. And the orthopedist told me to stay home. But anyway, it has nothing to do with the school. In any event, I was it has nothing to do with the great Royal Training Snyder, who's now passed away as well. But anyway, I saw the news, and Rock Hudson died. And he died. He was the first major celebrity to die from an AIDS-related illness. He died of, I think, pneumonia. But at the time, AIDS was primarily either a gay disease or a drug addict disease.
Mm-hmm.
And it was hidden in, San Francisco or in the alleys of New York or whatever. And you saw it on the news all the time. But I remember, and we talked about it in school, that, Rock Hudson dying was a huge awakening for the nation about AIDS research. And a few years later, it took a few years, but I remember, I think it was 89, I think President Bush put in approved or, the Congress put forth a $1 billion package for AIDS research. So, and of course, that would be piggybacked 6 years later when Magic Johnson.
Yeah, I feel like that was where AIDS really came on my radar, was Magic. Like, I feel like I don't really remember the Rock Hudson stuff at all.
No, the difference was Rock Hudson actually had AIDS.
Right, yeah, Magic had HIV.
HIV. He just carried it, but Rock Hudson actually – and they both died from – they both got it the same way because, Magic was a whore. But I remember that happened a few days before on this day, October 2nd, 1985. Rock Hudson died at the age of 59 from AIDS-related pneumonia. So there is your pop culture report for this day, October 5th, 1985, which I hope this will be better than the rest of the show we're going to continue with. So, all right.
I hope the rest of the show is better than AIDS, yes.
That's true, too. All right. We're back in the ring, JR, but not for a match.
No, it is wedding time. Time for some nuptials. As officially time for the hillbilly wedding. As the ring is adorned in the ceremony. For the ceremony, the groom and groomsmen stand tall in the ring. Gene breaks out his organ and plays "Here Comes the Bride." And Jesse said he looks like the Phantom of the Opera out there on the organ. The bride and her ladies make their way to the ring, and we finally get things out of the way. Jesse's on fire here throughout this whole thing. Says he wishes the moment wasn't being shared with him. We're sharing this moment with all of you. And he goes, I wish it wasn't being shared with me. The gist of the piece leads us to the ceremony, which is pretty straightforward. Vince asks Jesse if he'd like a framed picture of the couple in his living room, and Jesse scoffs and says the judge should be sentencing them to jail instead of marrying them. Jesse also jokes about Joyce being able to support Elmer. A fan pelts Joyce with a piece of trash, and then Jesse jokes about Elmer not being able to get the ring on his finger, saying it's like greasing a pig. Elmer butchers his vows, cracking up Jesse, and then they finally give him the rings. Piper comes out and tells them this shouldn't be happening, and they all stink before walking off. Everything settles down, and they seal it with a kiss as Jesse nails his iconic line. They look like two carp in the Mississippi River going after the same piece of corn. And then says, where's the slop bucket? I'm about to get sick.
Fantastic.
So much better than the Vachon wedding, at least. And only because of Jesse Ventura, who just destroys this thing the whole way through. I mean, just...
Oh, yeah.
If I didn't know better, I would say they only did this just so Jesse could be an asshole. I mean, he is just, like, from the jump, just burying this whole thing and everyone involved. And it was glorious, Gloria, as we heard earlier, but it was glorious. Yes. Just destroying them. I mean, some of the stuff he was saying was absurd. The
I think even
the
Vince was laughing.
Oh, he had to be. I mean, the carp line is like iconic. So yeah, it was entertaining and not the way it was probably intended, but it was entertaining. But I don't know. I don't get their fascination with weddings. Like, I don't know why we needed another one this soon after the Vachon one. But
Vachon was fucking terrible. Yeah. Oh, the Vachon was awful. Not as bad as this, but that was all. That was more because Captain Lou was fucking trashed.
Yeah, that was worse. This is better than that. But again, if Jesse wasn't on commentary, it was probably just would have been pretty boring. But Jesse makes it. I mean, Jesse's. It's worth watching this just for Jesse tearing these guys up.
Yes. No, I agree. I agree. Well, we'll get to the reception of this fine, fine combination of love and corn a little bit later on. But we're back to the ring, JR. And actually, I forgot about this match. Well, I didn't forget about it, but I occurred to me that we had this match as well. Also, heavy storylines going on here as we're following them via the house show as well. And this is the first time, JR, that we really see like these storylines kind of coalescing through the cities to the Garden and now finally made television. This tag team match follows what we've been following both. It happened in Toronto and, of course, what we had at the last house show.
Yeah, that was really cool because I feel like we watched this a year ago and probably had no idea. Like, you know, this feud had been raging on the house shows and exactly how they got to that point. Like, we've really learned a lot about it from watching those MSG shows. So it is Andre the Giant teaming with Tony Atlas, Mr. Junior Wonderful, whatever the fuck his name was.
Junior Welterweight or whatever
Junior
it was.
Junior Mr. Universe, I think that's what it was. John Studd and King Kong Bundy on the other side. Vince puts over Andre big time as he marches to the ring with a big smile on his face. And Vince reminds us that Andre got beaten down 2-on-1 back in Toronto. And Jesse says he doesn't think Tony Atlas will even make much of a difference here. Another big time matchup on the card as Andre finds a new partner to help in the war with Heenan, who now officially manages Bundy 2, like we talked about last week. Andre and Bundy kick things off, picking up where they left off at the Colossal Jostle. Andre chokes away at Bundy with a shoulder strap and then chops away and leans on him in the corner. Andre walks over to the crowd and runs Bundy's head into Atlas's and then tags Tony in. Bundy levels Atlas with a shoulder block but misses an elbow drop, allowing Tony to crack him with a headbutt. Bundy tags in Studd, who slams hard into Tony with a shoulder block. Tony absorbs the blow and unloads a pair of headbutts before failing to slam Studd. Studd smacks Tony around and then dodges an Atlas dropkick. Studd stomps away and then gets in Andre's face, allowing Bundy to come in and drop a splash on Tony. Studd kicked and clubbed away some more before Tony just slid over and tagged Andre. Andre and Studd get tied up and trade blows in the corner until Andre lands a big boot that knocks him to the floor. Bundy attacks Andre from behind and levels him with kicks and forearms. And suddenly, Studd wipes out Atlas on the floor. Bundy and Studd level Andre with avalanche flanches in the corner to draw the DQ, but they didn't care about the loss. They were just there, clearly, to hurt Andre. Andre does what he could to fend them off until Hulk Hogan shows up, still wearing his wedding attire, and makes the save for Andre. And that pisses off Jesse, who wants to know why he would be getting involved in this. The crowd goes wild as Hogan, Atlas, and Andre stand tall in the ring. And the match, again, was nothing, but the angle was so good. The heat was there, as always, with these guys. And it wasn't as fun as the Colossal Jostle, but still a very strong signings main event showcase. I thought it looked like Andre may have a new partner in the Wahine family as well with Hulk Hogan, which I thought was really cool to show off here on NBC. So I thought that was a smart idea. I went just one star. I mean, it's a short. It's kind of boring in the ring, you know, from that perspective. But the heat and the crowd and the build have all been really, really good for this. And I thought it was a nice installment as we continue to find that partner for Andre. You know, we've seen different variations, and now we get Atlas gives it a shot. But it looks like Hogan will be the guy going forward, at least in the near future. What did you think of this one, Scott?
I actually graded it a little higher. I think I really enjoyed it. I gave it 2 stars. I think it was a fun little brawl. I tell you, if we do end-of-year awards, I know we're still talking about it, but if we have an MVP, I got to give it to Bundy so far.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's been an animal, literally. I mean, he hasn't had a bad – I mean, relatively speaking, he hasn't had a bad match. Every match he's been energetic, and he's been you know, putting over himself and his opponent. The Colossal Jostle was great. I mean, when they were showing the clips from that Maple Leaf Gardens house show, I mean, he was crazy. He was running around like, and he was moving fast for a guy his size. This was fantastic. I've always been a stud guy, so I mean Tony Atlas was just kind of like, you know, collateral damage, I suppose.
That's fine. I mean, Andre's trying to find that partner, you know, who can work with him. We'll actually see it again next week too. He tries someone else. So he's trying to find his way and find a partner. And then Hogan makes a save, and it's really cool to see those two guys potentially being paired up.
Yeah, no, definitely. And, Andre Hogan, obviously, you know, maybe this was planned. Maybe Hogan's 85 was not going that great, and maybe he needed to siphon off a little of Andre's, you know, heat to kind of help put him over. I mean, I'm just throwing stuff at the wall. But this was a great match. I thought it was a lot of fun, and continues this great feud. Andre still obviously crazy over. Bundy is a beast. Stud's a beast. I enjoyed it. I thought it was a lot of fun. I might be overgrading it a little, but that's all right. I think it was a good template of.
Well, it's definitely been helped by watching the feud unfold.
Right.
And seeing Andre trying to find a way to settle the score with the Heenan family after what they've done to him, especially with the attack in Toronto and then leading to the Colossal Jostle, which, you know, ended similarly. So I think it's, you know, they're working their way toward this as Andre works his way back to the company after his break. Gene hops in the ring to chat with Andre Hogan and Atlas as Hulk talks yet again tonight. It's like his fifth time. Explaining that he made his way out because of the shortcuts and he wanted to help the winners of the match. Hulk says they have a big announcement. They'll be coming in just a little bit. So we tease that. We then cut to the jungle, Scott, where Gene Oakland pulls up in a Jeep on the search for a cunning creature. And that creature is George Steele, reported to have been seen in the Detroit Zoological Park. Gene would indeed happen upon the animal, who claims the entire world's been looking for him. He informs us we haven't seen George since his electrotherapy that caused him to eventually relapse and disappear. And, of course, we watched that. We'll be coming up on an upcoming TNT installment on the WWE Network adventure. In a funny bit, Gene saw a tiger and asked what it was, leading to George to reply, Detroit, and then called the hippo Bundy. And after some more hijinks, George ran away. And again, just a quick killer, time killer to push along Steele's face turn that has kind of played out at first on our first Iron Man event, on our house shows, and our TNTs as well. So again, that electrotherapy is a pretty well-known segment. We'll be covering it on our TNT in a few weeks on the adventure, so stay tuned for that. But again, just kind of pushing that along. Any thoughts on that?
It's George Animal Steel, whatever. God rest his soul. It's all good. I like when they were standing next to the mud puddle with the hippo, and he goes, Bundy! That's pretty funny.
I did think he was pretty funny. The Detroit thing was funny, too. What kind of tiger is that, George? Detroit?
Detroit?
Gene, very busy on this night, then talks to the Dream Team about their issues with the U.S. Express. Gene says how Johnny V used his cigar to help facilitate the tag title change. We see the closing moments of that bout, and then we find out the U.S. Express will be sitting ringside, Scott, for our next matchup.
Mm-hmm. And our next matchup is a World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Championship match as the Dream Team takes on a very interesting babyface team, the team of Tony Garea and Leaping Lanny Poffo.
And Garea is actually a sub here for, take a guess,
George Wells.
Yes, the man with the never-ending eye injury who's missing all these shows. Subbed out again. Looks like they had some pretty good plans for Georgie Wells. He's on a lot of these big matches. He's getting subbed out. He's going to be on Steiner's main event.
No, I was going to say something very funny about Garea. If you remember the TNT JR where Garea came on the show, I think it was in 84. It was 84 because it was when the shows, I think, were still 90 minutes or 2 hours, I guess, 90 minutes of stuff. I know. Never want to watch those again. But the one episode where he's on, and I see him standing, next to Lanny Poffo. Lanny's got his poofy hair and his little jacket. And Tony Gurria goes, when Vince asks him, so
well, it could have been 84 if it was Lanny Poffo, right? Because he didn't come in until mid
85. No, but this is that one. Yeah, no, one has something to do with the other. It's just reminding me. Seeing him with Lanny Poffo reminds me of this episode.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
And Vince asks him, you know, you're looking for a. A new tag partner, you know, former four-time tag team champion, and Gurria gives this smirk and he goes, yes, I have my eyes on some good young boys. See him with Papa with his puffy hair and his jacket and his, you know, eloquent poetry, and I'm like, yeah, okay.
Yeah,
there you go.
Of course, the Dream Team did win the tag team titles back on August 24th when, indeed, Johnny V took his lit cigar and burned Barry Windham's eye with it. And Windham is at ringside, the U.S. Express, and his eye is under a patch, so he's got it all patched up, still nursing that injury. Brand new tag champs, the Dream Team, made their partnership official, struck gold, defeating the U.S. Express, managed by Johnny V instead of Jimmy Hart now. He's fully out of the picture. Remember, they had kind of been co-managing these guys before they became an official team. Showcase against a pair of Jobber to the Stars, show off the champs on national TV. The Express sitting ringside for this one, keeping the title feud burning. Valentine starts things off by clubbing away at Poffo, wasting no time beating on the poet laureate of the WWF. Poor Barry Windham has to sit there with that eye patch. So he's sitting there with the eye patch, looking all sad. And then they add salt to the wounds by putting ex-WWF tag team champions under the graphic, under their names, like as they're sitting there looking stupid. Poffo heats up and works over both champions before hitting a nice moonsault on Beefcake for two before Valentine makes a save. Beefcake recovers and slugs away, and the champs took turns battering Lanny with strikes. Jesse credits the champs for keeping the action in the corner. Poffo finally escapes and tags in Gurria, who comes in hot and batters Beefcake and Valentine around, picking up a near fall on a body press. Gurria hammers away but runs into a Beefcake back elbow. Valentine tags in and drops an elbow and then finishes Tony with the figure four. This was fine and effective, but really just a squash and nothing more to continue building the heat on the champs, teasing more of a feud with the Express to continue on. So again, perfectly fine for this late in the show. I think it's just a way to say, here are our tag champs, you know, showing them off. What'd you think of the Dream Team? And we've talked a little bit about them winning the titles, but what'd you think of their role here? Do you like that they're seemingly keeping the U.S. Express in the title feud?
Well, it's funny because I'm looking right now on the history of the history of WWE.com and our good friend Brent Graham Cawthon, because I'm trying to see when he left.
It's soon, because next week on our next show, he's not there.
Yeah, I'm looking ahead. I mean, I'm like on October 20th.
It had to be within this 3 weeks because he's not at that October 21st hour show.
It looks like on October 16th. He's in a six-man Dream Team and Johnny V against Barry, Rotundo, and Captain Lou. Title match on the 17th in Rochester. And then the following day on the 18th is when the subbing starts.
Yep.
So I think October 17th is his last.
Okay. So between this show and next week's show, he's gone.
Yeah. Yep. So.
Yeah, and that plays out. We'll see that next week.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was fine. I mean, I remember my brother being a big Dream Team mark. He loved Valentine and Beefcake. I mean, it was a good filler. You know, I think back then as a fan, you were just kind of – you were happy enough that there were, quote, title matches that you know, normally didn't get to see on prime times or, you know, the superstars or whatever. So it was nice to have a title match, even though you knew clearly that, you know, the Dream Team were not going to lose here. It was fine. It was good. It was what it was. And I got to say, I mean, during this stretch, and we'll see it more as we get into 1986, Beefcake definitely, you know, took a lot from Greg Valentine's learning tree. And he was a lot more independent as a tag team worker as time would progress. He wasn't, you know, just doing punches, kicks, tag, and let Valentine do all the work. He definitely kind of got it eventually. And so I think he did a great job of learning from Valentine, you know, the ropes of the ring and that kind of thing. So, but again, a pretty straight up tag title defense, and the Dream Team retain their World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Championships. So with the in-ring stuff out of the way, here we go.
We do head backstage to that big wedding reception. Vince, Jesse, Hogan, and Orndorff sitting at a table chatting. Hogan says this. Hogan thinks this could really rocket Elmer to the top of the promotion. So there you go. The wedding, apparently, him getting married is going to rocket him up. Gene visits another table where Cousin Junior and Lou Albano are chowing down like slobs. Poffo's at the table in his tights as well, and he reads a poem that he wrote for the happy couple. The poem, of course, includes a plug for NBC. Hibbly Jim's the best man, proposes his toast, and informs the couple he'll be over for dinner every Sunday. Gene then welcomes in a surprise guest, musician Tiny Tim. Gene informs us that Tim has been involved in TV's most famous wedding until tonight. Tim is sure to mention that his wedding didn't work out, but implores Elmer to be good to his wife and then gives him a ukulele as a gift. As Tim leaves, Jesse walks up and reads a poem of his own, one that started nicely but degenerates into a string of insults. Hibbly doesn't take too kindly to that, hops to his feet, and shoves Jesse into a cake, into a chorus of laughter. Before we wrap up, we get Vince and Hogan revealing that Hulk Hogan will team with Andre the Giant to battle King Kong Bundy and Big John Studd in 4 weeks at our next Saturday Night's Main Event. Thoughts on the reception, Scott?
No. everybody was dressed so well, you know. I mean, you know, Hogan had a shirt with no sleeves, and fucking Orndorff had a polo shirt on, and
Jesse was good again.
Well, Jesse was tremendous. It was fun. Let's put it this way: it was less annoying than Mad Dog Vachon's reception in the fucking KFC hall.
Well, that was only funny because all the what's his name was tripping everyone. Blassie
and fucking what's his name? Dr. D. David Schultz is getting trashed, and Albano was being a dick. It was terrible. It was fine. I mean, the pigs and everything. It was okay.
Tiny Tim was very random, but I liked him basically saying, like, oh, my marriage fell apart, but that shouldn't stop you guys. You'll be okay.
Here's this ukulele. That'll help.
Weirdo.
And he comes back 8 years later.
He sure does.
So I'll need it. You 8 years later.
That wraps up this week's Saturday Night's event, number two. I don't know. I don't know if it's better than the first one, but I don't think it was significantly worse, per se, than the first one.
No, it was all right. I mean, we're being...
About on par, I'd say.
Because the hillbillies are annoying, but honestly, for the most part, it's not. It's fine.
Okay. Let's do our awards, and we'll see further.
Let's do the awards.
So match of the night, I think this is obvious. I had Paul Orndorff versus Piper for the second time. Is going to win that award. They won it back in our July 13th house show as well.
Yes, I agree, definitely.
All right, the Drizzler, which is the worst match of the night, I think, again, pretty easily. I went with Uncle Elmer and Mr. Valiant.
Mr. City Slicker.
It's the big City Slicker. Cannot check in with a big match tonight. You agree?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Our MVP of the night, I went with, actually, Jesse Ventura on this one, Scott.
Yeah.
I thought he was the best part of this whole show. I thought he was fantastic on commentary. He was great in the body shop, just trashing the wedding. And if you want to pick an on-screen performer, you know, probably go to Andre or Hogan. But I thought Jesse was consistently the best presence, and I thought he made this easily worth watching.
Yep, I agree 100%. Jesse was fantastic. From the body shop to the fucking commentary during the wedding to the poem, he was on his game tonight.
Yes, he was excellent. Yep. All right, the spoiler award, the worst worker. I think Uncle Elmer is very clearly the easy choice here again.
Yes.
I thought everyone else is at least serviceable, like even in that tag match. Like, Gurria and Poffa aren't bad. Obviously the Andre match, they're all good. Piper Orndorff, Valiant, whatever. I think Elmer's clearly the worst worker, and they had to bury him in a 6-second match just to keep him from being exposed. So I think Elmer's the easy choice.
Yes. No, there's no doubt about it. Very easy.
All right, best moment, I went with the backstage brawl between Piper and Orndorff.
I was in the middle of a sneeze. I didn't want to sneeze on the air. Okay. The post-match brawl in the hallway with slamming the door and everything. That was red hot. And even though the bounty didn't totally take a okay. Sneeze was still on deck. dominate the match. The fact that it was in the background and Piper collecting money is pretty cool. So I agree. Post-match.
And that's the second time he's won that as well. Back in September, the post-match between those two guys was the best moment.
Yes.
The Junior Mr. Universe Award, of course, the most roided up. I didn't think there was that many guys on the show that really fit the bill. He's always in the running. I actually went with Hogan this week. I thought Hogan looked the biggest. I mean, especially when you saw him like in that ripped-up suit and everything. I thought he actually shined a little bit more than Atlas this week.
Yeah, he definitely looked like he bulked up a little bit. I think it's the white tights. Like, sometimes he looks a little trimmer in the regular red and yellow, but when he wears a different color, I feel like he's bulkier.
Even in that suit, he looked the ripped off suit. He looked like huge too. I mean, Atlas is always in the conversation. It's his award, but I'm going to go with Hogan on this one. I think.
Yeah, I'm fine with that. I like that idea.
And then the overall grade, I went with a 5 out of 10. I thought it was pretty much down the middle. I wouldn't call it a great show. I wouldn't call it a bad show. There was enough here to keep me entertained. all the hillbilly jackass bullshit was still, I mean, even that had its moments because of Jesse keeping it alive. But that whole brigade is just fucking, so fucking annoying. I mean, like I said, Junior is the worst. I mean, Junior is just awful. That dopey looking stupid fucking face and that dance.
Absolutely terrible. Absolutely terrible.
Terrible.
Yeah. When we did it, when we did the refresh on the site, I remember giving this a 3.5 because it's just a lot of the stuff is just atrocious. But Jesse will bump it up for me. I'm not going to go as high as you. I'm going to give it a 4.5. Jesse was really great. The title match was solid, and the Piper Orndorff stuff was awesome. But the rest of it was just shit, and the hillbilly stuff just kind of ruined it for me. So I'll give it a. I'm going to give it a 4.5.
Wow. And rare most of it's Scott lower than me.
Yeah, and most of it's Jesse and the first three matches. Well, three of the first four matches.
All right, there you go.
The Hogan title match, the obviously the Piper Orndorff brawl, and I love the Andre, you know, interaction with Bundy and Stud. That carried it. The hillbilly stuff just drags it way down for me. So there you go.
All right, another one in the books, Scotty.
Yes.
Sounds might have been down. Yep. All right, so next Monday we'll be back. Kelly Nelson returns for his second trip around. We'll be looking at the October 21st 85 House Show, so a few weeks after this one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we'll dive into that. A couple of big matches on tap for that show.
Yes.
And, of course, always good to have Kelly in the house, so buckle in. I'm sure there'll be a little bit lengthier episode than what you had here tonight. I also want to promote the ROH 50, Scott, that's out right now, that began dropping today, of course. It was ballots that we took in cohesion with Voices of Wrestling, and Brad Woodling put a lot of effort and work into this one. And basically today they released the top non-performer list. That was a separate voting list. And now they will start rolling out this week the top 50 in-ring performers in Ring of Honor history by vote. I mean, we had a lot of votes, Scott. It was quite a bit through social media and other, you know, message boards and whatnot. So be sure to check that out as it rolls out this week. In addition to, as you mentioned earlier, our annual WrestleMania project this year, we're doing 33 lists in 33 days. And of course, we've done sets, we've done taglines, we've done the national anthems, we've done, of course, right up to today, to arenas. There's been 7 in total. And then we have, 26 more to go. So mm-hmm. be sure to check that out as we roll toward WrestleMania 33. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't signed up yet and you are attending that show and you want to be part of our tailgate that day, we have a big crew going down. Nick Duke is the master of the tailgate. I highly recommend taking part of that if you can make it. So if you'll be in Orlando for WrestleMania and you want to be part of the tailgate, just reach out to us on social media, Twitter, place2bnation, facebook.com/place2bnation as well. Tumblr, Instagram, we're there too. So be sure to reach out to us. Let us know if you want to be part of that or if you have any other questions or feedback for the show. We always appreciate you listening and following us on iTunes, subscribing and rating us there, leaving comments. And of course, placemediation.com/Amazon for all your shopping needs as well. Scott, you got main event this week? What's going on?
Yes, I do have main event this week. We will recap Fastlane and look ahead. Maybe start talking once again. We've talked about it now two shows in a row. We'll talk about the women's division. So I think we're going to focus on that because for the first time, on the Raw side of pay-per-view last night, the Raw women's match did not deliver. Usually it does and kind of helps carry the rest of the show. A flat women's match is not a good sign for these Raw pay-per-views, and it showed last night. So we're going to talk about that. Talk a little NXT, talk about the big Hall of Fame announcement tonight, as that class is filling up very nicely. I think you're in for a pretty good performance at the Amway Center in Orlando that Friday night, JR. I had a great line. Oh, Nick Duke tailgate. I plan it, then forget it.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Amazing tailgate. He is a master. And this year is promising to be bigger, badder, better, according to our group. So,
good.
We just got the hot breaking news too. Steve Willie, last minute addition to our WrestleMania crew. So we're very excited.
Good. Awesome.
Willie's coming down. So, looking very much forward to that. So Scott, I will talk to you next week.
Yes.
And, of course, there'll be a new Clotheslines and Headlines next week as well, but we're off mm-hmm. this week, so keep an eye out for that. And listen to last week's episode, by the way. Great interview with Kevin Kelly. Mm-hmm. Talked all about his career, what's going on in New Japan, his issues with Ring of Honor, of course, still working there as a commentator. And then you can also check that episode out for an awesome chat with Brad Stutz, led by our buddy Pete Schiermacher. Talked all about Brad's booking philosophies and, you know, how he's come up with, you know, what his inspirations are and whatnot. So it's a really cool look back or look into inside CWF and how Brad promotes that and books that promotion. So if you're a fan of the indies or just kind of booking in general, check that interview out. It was really, really good. Anyway, we're out. We'll be back next week. Kelly will be in the house gloating about that Blue Jays divisional win, I'm sure. And, of course, we'll be looking at the playoffs, too, by next week, Scott. So,
yes.
Kelly, yep. It's Blue Jay glory. But until then, thanks for listening. We'll talk to you in a week's time. And stay away from all those hibbly weddings. They're fucking terrible. Awful, terrible.
And stink. And maybe there'll be a great movie called Cock Robin and Ray Dong Chong.
It's like Rotella and Armento going after the same piece of pizza left on the table at the Knights of Columbus Day. I never scheme or lie, Bill.